Hi, this is Rachel.
And this is Christy.
And welcome back to Constant Chaos. Hi, we're here with Melissa Nolan. She is a local advocate and educational psychologist and also a past school administrator and also a mother of a kid with dyslexia and ADHD. Anything else?
Dysgraphia.
Wow, that's a handful.
Yeah, it is.
So thank you for coming in and talking with us today. I'm really excited for you to be able to share your knowledge and answer our questions. So before we get started, I thought you could share a little bit about your own journey. You know, I remember when I first met you, I was intrigued because you had said at the time, the district that you were in didn't help your kid, but you wanted to be able to change things so your kid would be the last not to be helped. And that really struck me.
Oh, thank you for remembering that. I remember that night too. So it's been a journey. And the thing that makes me sad is that I know so much about special education because this was my training. I was trained as a school psychologist and then went into school administration. And knowing as much as I do, it was still very hard for me and my husband. And there were a lot of times that I would still, before IEPs or after IEPs, come home and cry and just feel really deflated. And so I can only imagine what it feels like for a typical parent who doesn't have that experience, how, you know, just difficult the process is. Mm-hmm.
Did you use somebody as an advocate?
I didn't, because again, I knew what to do. I think the part that made me so sad is that I knew that my team, they're good human beings. Mm-hmm. It's not that they wanted to harm my child, but I think that they were scared because they knew about my training. And so rather than it being more collaborative at times, I felt that there was a lot of defensiveness.
Oh, interesting.
And so it just wasn't a natural kind of process of us working together at times.
Right.
And this was early on. The team got better over time, but especially initially when we moved here, I just felt like the walls were up and that it was an authentic experience. And that really made me sad.
Can we rewind a bit and just like tell us a little bit about when you figured out that there might be some challenges for your son?
Okay, so we moved from one area of California to the East Bay. Mm-hmm. And our services before, I would say, were a little stronger.
And how old was your child?
He was on the peninsula for kindergarten and first grade, and then we kept him back when we moved here. So he came here he was in first grade.
And did you know he had dyslexia or ADHD?
Yes. Yeah, I knew early on. I would say even as early as preschool, I knew there were some language-based difficulties, some speech and language, some occupational therapy issues. And so when he started in kindergarten, we had even talked about, should we keep him back a year? And then we thought, no, let's just have him move forward. But as early as kindergarten, we were working with the team, and he qualified early on for services.
So you were doing earlier intervention?
No, this was after, yeah. So it was in kindergarten that we started. So EI would have started even before he was in kindergarten.
Mm-hmm.
So we really started with support. We were paying privately for support for him when he was in preschool and then got him identified on an IEP in kindergarten.
And had he been diagnosed by a doctor?
He had been, I'm trying to think back. He had been diagnosed with, I think, like just speech and language issues.
Okay.
But as far as the dyslexia, that came a little bit later.
Okay.
Yeah. And the dysgraphia. So I would say those full assessments where it came more in his first grade year.
And did you have to do that privately or?
We chose to do it privately.
Mm-hmm.
Just because, again, I wanted to, because I do assessments myself. And I just kind of wanted it to be outside of school, that there wasn't somebody pulling him from class at different times. I wanted it to be done, you know, just one fluid experience for him and by somebody that I really trusted.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, he was tested by a psychologist that I knew and who also had kind of a broader perspective. It was beyond just kind of a school-based assessment.
And is that something you believe in? Was this because of your child that you wanted to do private? Is this because of the school district?
I would say it's because of my experience that I've learned over time that you want to know who your assessors are. And I knew who the psychologist was from when he was in kindergarten. And it's not that she was a terrible assessor. I just wanted somebody who had a broader perspective that really kind of knew dyslexia, that knew dysgraphia, and was beyond just like kind of looking at the 13 categories of eligibility through special education, was somebody who had a broader perspective.
Well, wouldn't it be nice if everyone had that?
I know. Well, that's right. That's the thing. So we didn't have that experience. So it's interesting to me to hear from, you know, professionals, you know, and looking back, like, how would you do it differently? Or what, you know, what were some of the tools or techniques that you're probably more familiar with that we had no idea?
Right. And I also thought the school district made you do their testing. So I was always told that if you had outside testing done and you brought that to the district, that they would insist on doing their own.
The district still needs to do an assessment.
Okay.
But an assessment can mean different things. And it depends on your relationship with that team. I was able to get the team not to do as much testing because the person that I was bringing in, they also knew who she was and she was very reputable. And so the assessment came in. And so they, the school district, then did observations. They did some cognitive testing, but again, it wasn't the extent of testing that would typically have been done. So yes, the district does need to do their own assessment, but assessment doesn't necessarily
have to be the full battery of tests that like a neuropsychologist would do.
Not necessarily.
Oh, interesting.
So if you did the whole neuropsych test and you gave that to the district, they may just do a shortened or a smaller version of that.
They might. You have to work with your team.
We did the reverse with my son. We had the school test first because that's kind of the process we were in. And then we took that testing to a professional and asked them to interpret it for us and then figure out what needed to be deeper and then test my son that way.
And then did that change what happened with your IEP team?
Yes.
Okay.
Because that's where we got the full diagnosis. Before that, it was just sort of special services. Mm-hmm. And then it was very specific dyslexia, dysgraphia, ADHD.
Mm-hmm. You really can do it either way. I just wanted to have a comprehensive assessment mm-hmm. with a conclusion. And so I knew what I was coming in with to the team that I trusted.
Right.
And then from there, the team worked with me and we were able to put together a plan.
And that was when he was in about first grade?
That was kindergarten.
Okay.
Yeah. And then into first grade, he had intensive services. He actually had an aide. Actually, at the end of kindergarten, he got an aide.
In the classroom. And so how did that work?
How did the aide support my son?
Uh-huh.
She went in and he has attention-related issues. So there was a lot of redirection, reteaching. And because he was, you know, he took more time than the teacher really could give to him.
Right.
And it's interesting because with the classroom we were in, it was a public school, but there were 20 kids in the class at the time. So it was a smaller class, but the academic demands, it was pretty quick pace. Mm-hmm. So really having that other adult in there with him to redirect, to reteach. And she also assisted other kids in the class. It was really beneficial. And we had that through first grade. And then when we moved to the East Bay, we found that it wasn't as needed.
And is that something the school provided for you or was that?
It was, yeah, the district was through an IEP process. Uh-huh. Right, right.
Okay. Interesting.
But that was definitely me working with the team and my professionals coming in and kind of looking at it and all of us thinking together, working together to try to figure it out. So they did a lot of things that were not as traditional. Like they even allowed me to have a tutor come on campus and work with him during the school day. And that's not typical. I think a lot of public schools
we tried to do that.
Yeah. So I think it really depends on your team. And because I think it's more typical to see that the team will resist that.
We had a ton of resistance about that. And also one of the things I was trying to do early on was my son was very adamant that school was too much. That time, you know, that was a long day for him and it was exhausting trying to keep up and trying to stay on pace and absorb the information. And so anything after that, so we would do private tutoring after that and try, and it would always fail because he was exhausted. And mm-hmm. so what I wanted to do with the school district was take him out early or, you know, figure mm-hmm. a way to use those elective type courses like PE or whatnot. And they resisted that every single time. They would not let me take him out during that time frame, which was super hard. So
right.
It's so interesting to hear this different
things are possible. things are possible. I think that there's resistance to doing things differently, but it's not until everybody's thinking outside of the box that these possibilities, like what happened with my son, could happen. Again, it's my background, my experience, the people that I knew how to set it up so that when we got there, it worked.
Right.
And we had a wonderful team. This was, again, when we were on the peninsula. They were really working with us. And it worked out beautifully. It really did. Yeah. And so when we came to the East Bay, it's not that the team was bad. I mean, they wanted to do well, but I think it was, there was fear because they didn't know how to handle me. They didn't know if I was going to come after them later and request. I think that's why a lot of times, like with your experience, there's fear.
It felt defensive. Everything always felt very defensive. And so it was very hard to get past that barrier.
It always feels like they have their own agenda. Like they meet before you have an IEP meeting and they have an agenda of what they're going to do. And then you have the meeting and
you get managed through it.
You get managed through to the end that they want versus like, okay, let's talk about what our this child truly needs.
Right. And that's unfortunate because it's supposed to be the latter. It's supposed to be a team approach because the parent's perspective is so essential. And, you know, I've been doing this for over 25 years and I've only met a handful of parents that I would say were unreasonable. I would say the majority of parents really kind of know, and it's not until you're putting the walls up that they can get more defensive themselves.
Oh yeah. That's
and
me.
So, yeah. Right. Right. So I wish it could be different. That's why, again, when you heard me say, I want to make it different, it's more of educating people so they can hear what can be done. What are some solutions? Because I think a lot of times the school district doesn't know what to do differently, and they're hopeful that their methodology, what they've been doing, will make a difference. But the one size fits all, it doesn't work. Yeah. And so then you have parents that are suffering that then feel like they're the only ones that are asking for something unreasonable when they're not. There's lots of parents feeling that way in different districts. And yeah.
So in terms of your business, when do you recommend having an advocate? Like, I don't know if that's the right question, but at what point do you feel like a family is in this process, they know something's wrong? How do you kind of step in so they come to you? Like, when do they need you? How does that work?
It's when they need me.
So how do they know when they need you?
When they start getting that sense that they're not working as a team, that things are not going well, when their kid is not responding, even though there's a plan in place, or if there isn't a plan in place.
Or their kid's not getting services.
The timing is different for different families because I'll talk to parents because I'll get lots of calls saying, oh, I'm not sure if it's time for me to bring you in yet. I know if I bring you in, it's going to make the dynamics of the team change. And I respect that because a lot of times it can change the dynamics when you bring advocate in. But it's really depending on how well that kid is doing. Are they making progress? Has it been a while and the parents feeling like, you know, they're doing the same thing over and over again? There isn't a positive end result. The kid is stressed out. They're still getting bad report cards. It's different for everybody. Some people have a lower tolerance for when it's time to get an advocate, whereas others, their kids are in high school and they're calling. And they're like, we've been seeing this since they were a third grader. And now I feel tremendous guilt because I didn't do something earlier. And that's where I try to tell them, don't beat yourself up. You trusted, which we all want to trust.
You want to trust the system. You want to know that that's...
You want to. And some schools are amazing and they earn that trust. So it's not that all public schools are bad. They really aren't. And you can be in a school where one teacher is maybe giving advice that isn't the best, where another teacher on the same campus is tremendous. So it's really case by case. So to answer your question, how do you know? It's when it keeps coming up and you still don't have resolution.
Sure.
Then I would talk to somebody. And then after talking to that person, it might not even be the right advocate because there's lots of different personality types for advocates. You know, some are very aggressive, whereas others might not get enough of a result that you're wanting. And then there's everything in between. So it's interviewing to find the right person that's a match for your family.
Do you find that families stay with you a long period of time? Like, are you watching kids grow up through the system?
Yes.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm.
So they'll even call me year after year just to check in and say, hey, we have the IEP meeting coming up. Talk me through this. And then I'll look at the, you know, are they meeting their goals? You know, what information do you have? What is the classroom teacher saying now? Yeah. So yes, they do stay with you because you build up this trust and they know that you know their case. And I go and observe the student in the classroom ahead of time and that they stay in my mind. Yeah. So you do stay connected with the family.
So I know some people find that they at some point go to a lawyer for if there's really disconnect, their kids aren't getting the services. Mm-hmm. Do you ever direct your clients in that way, or do you advocate for them if there needs to be a more serious action?
Yes. So basically what I do is I can carry cases all the way from IEP meetings all the way through mediation.
Okay.
When we're looking at due process, that's where you're absolutely going to want an attorney. And so most advocates have attorneys that they work with, that they have a relationship with. And so there's kind of a collaboration where if I feel like it's getting to a point where we're going to need an attorney, I already start talking to the attorney. And then so that when it is time, you hand the case off. I will try to manage it as much as possible. Mm-hmm. But if I feel from talking to the district that they are just set with what they're saying and they really are convinced that there is no other way than what they're offering, and the parent is completely in a different direction and I'm talking to them and they're anxious and they feel like their kid needs more and my gut on it as well, then I'll know that, you know, this is something that needs to go to an attorney. And I usually let the district know that, well, with the parent's permission, you know, I'll talk and I'll say, would it be okay with you if I start already letting the district know that you're heading in that direction? Because as I'm negotiating with the district, it's good for them to know, right? Because maybe they aren't showing me all their cards and they are trying to see how far they can get.
That goes back to it not being on the same page, right?
Yeah. And it's really not in the district's best interest to have an attorney involved because it's just so much, it's more
expensive. It costs so much money for everybody.
It really is. Because then they have to contact their attorney, and then the parent is paying for their attorney. And if the parent later on requests reimbursement for attorney costs, all of that is just, and then the relationship gets worse. There's just so many reasons not to get to that level.
So one of the things that always concerns me is how much of this process are you dragging this child through? Especially if you're going to find out that public school is not this, you know, this particular situation is not the right situation, right? So sort of the due process, right? And making sure that you have done everything you can. When you get to that point, there seems to be so much that's put back on the child because they're going through this process with you, right? They're sitting in the classroom. They're feeling like it's not working. They're frustrated. They're being tested all the time. They're either being pulled out or there's someone in the room with them. You know, they've got peers that are judging this. So that by itself for the child brings so much anxiety to the table and creates so much stress for the family. At what point do you look at that and say, you know, sort of enough's enough, but the district needs to refer to a non-public school?
Well, this is where if you work with somebody who knows the options in the area, it's important to work with somebody who knows the options in the area. Because all along, you should be researching, okay, if this isn't working, what are the choices? So let's say you have a child with dyslexia. And there are options in the community that can really remediate the dyslexia, especially if you get it early on and even later, but especially the earlier on, the better. Mm-hmm. It might be in the parent's best interest to, rather than investing in an advocate, rather than investing in attorney fees, rather than going through the whole process, it might be better for that parent to know about this center that's in your community that can help you.
A Linda Mood Bell or a reading center.
Yes. I'm not using names, but exactly.
Yeah.
That's what you told me. I mean, I remember when I met with you like 6 months ago with my son, you said you can push for all these services in the district. At the end of the day, they're not going to be able to give you the level you need. And do you just want to do it privately and get him while he was young? He was in kindergarten, or fight them?
But then what are we saying? Are we saying that schools can't teach these kids?
I would say our schools need help. I think that there's people within the schools that can teach our kids, but they need the training and they need the ongoing support to make it happen. It's not, things are not set up universally to provide that degree of support. And I'm talking about dyslexia right now. And it's different. It's different case by case. That's why
Everybody's degree of what they have is very different.
And so with this example of dyslexia, if as an advocate, I know what the options are, my job is to say to the parent, these are your options, but some parents can't afford it. So if you have a parent that then can look at it and say, okay, rather than the stress of a difficult relationship with the school district, rather than the stress of bringing, you know, paying for the advocate coming to the meetings or maybe the attorney and maybe going to a non-public school, maybe rather than fighting all that, I want to put my resources into this instead. So a good advocate will give you those options along the way. So you don't wait until the absolute end where your kid is not wanting to go to school and you're incredibly stressed out and you're like, okay, we need to go to another school. That you don't, and it gets to that point for some families, but if you can get there earlier and see what the options are and make an educated rather than reactive decision, that can be very helpful for families, but it doesn't always work out that way.
Yeah. I want to go back to what Christy was saying. It is super frustrating that, I mean, in my case, I feel like I gave up on the school. I'm just like, you know what? They can't do it. And I didn't want to risk my kid. And of course we could afford it. And I think about all the people that can't afford that. And the school's going to keep on doing what they're doing. And with whatever the reason is, whether it's resources or it's run badly.
Well, you look at the classroom sizes now and you look at just the dynamic of what we're talking about. I mean, each child probably has their different cocktail of learning. You've got some that are needing high advanced AP type classes early on, right? They move quicker. Yeah. They think faster. They get it quicker. And then you've got the tail end of the ones that are kind of getting dragged along.
And that's where the parent has to do their research by talking to other parents, by having people come in to observe to see what is the quality of your program. If you have somebody in there that can do a multi, back to the dyslexia example, a multi-sensory individualized program for that kid and that person's good, then we would be fighting for the services with that person. But if you don't have those services, then you need to, in a sense, save your kid during that time of development. And you're taking care of that while at the same time, what we're doing is then creating a group to educate parents in the community and have that support in place so that we can get support for other kids. So it's not just about my kid, it's also about other kids that will benefit from the education that comes from bringing in speakers who specialize in these different areas.
Yeah, Melissa just organized it. Who's that? The doctor that came in, he's amazing.
James Byland.
Oh, amazing.
He did a really nice talk. So, I mean, that's how I personally have been approaching it. Like, I was able to, quote unquote, save my kid.
Right.
But then what about the other? It still doesn't sit well with me that we don't have a solid program. And the reason I know we don't have is because I still get calls all the time from parents in our community saying, you know, what do I do with my kid? What do I do with my kid?
And we're in this, you know, affluent community in the East Bay, right? So,
yes.
I mean, look at some of the schools that are not and how do they run? And then the other thing that always comes to mind for me is it's back on the parent.
So yeah, we talk about that all the time.
The stress of, so I know something's wrong and I know I need to get my child help in some way, money or no money.
Mm-hmm.
I need to prepare for these meetings, even if I have an advocate.
Right.
You still have this stress in the home of, mm-hmm. I need to protect my child. I need to get what's right for them. I need to make sure I'm on the ball in this meeting when I just feel like I'm going to cry.
Right.
And thankfully I have an advocate that's helping me, right,
yes.
go through this process. But it's still on that parent to find the advocate, find the tutors, call and make sure they're a good fit, meet with the people. So if you think about
do the extra work with the kids.
Keep the kid calm. So if you think about that, that is a full-time job all by itself. And what if you don't have a parent like that? Or even if you do, how do you sleep at night? Okay. I mean, that's the stress that comes back like to me whenever I talk to people and they're like, you know, what should I do? Or what was your experience? It like comes flooding back.
Right.
And I just think, oh.
Not to mention that those kids, there's that huge comorbidity with ADHD and dyslexia.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like your kid at home is like super easy and going to help with you and work.
No.
They're off the walls.
They don't even want to brush their teeth. I mean, we talk about this all the time. They don't want to do anything.
It's very
or funny. They want to do what they want to do, and you can't give them three things like, can you please help me do X, Y, and Z? It's like, let me ask you to do one thing, and then let me show you and make sure you do it at the same time.
Let me walk over there and help you hang up your backpack, and then we'll take your lunchbox and walk together to the kitchen.
It's difficult. So then what do? So the parent has to do self-care. I think it's you find your people. You talk to other moms. You do what you're doing. You share your wisdom with other families so that people know they're not alone, because they are not alone. You're not alone. I promise you that.
I'm always surprised at how much of a community that exists out there.
I feel
once
like
you
it's
start
all
talk, once you start talking,
yeah.
But nobody wants to talk. There's so much shame for the parent. I mean, I'm sure. Actually, do you see that? Like, how much shame is involved for some of these families?
I do see some shame, but I also see more suffering. And I see that with time that these parents are wanting to connect with other people. So it's a process. It's a mourning process. And the mourning can be that the sadness of, wait a minute, I thought when I sent my child to school that things were going to be taken care of. And then the guilt of, wait a minute, I expected that. It didn't happen. And I waited too long to do something about it. Mm-hmm. And am I the only one? Am I the difficult parent that now the school's not going to like me because I'm speaking up? All of those different emotions happen. And then with time, I think I like to think that we evolve when you realize that my priority is my kid and I'm getting them help and it's making a difference. And then connecting with others. And I'm hopeful. Well, that's what I've done for myself and we're trying to do with other parents.
Yeah.
But it doesn't happen everywhere. And so I think you guys are giving gift to people with, you know, a podcast about what it's like.
Because I feel like it's the real deal, right? I mean, it's like, this is the real deal. This is my real life. This is the real journey we're on.
It's not always pretty. I was encouraged at our meeting last week about dyslexia in our community. We had probably at least 40 people there.
Yes.
And people that...
I was so excited.
Yeah. And we were able to bring in a speaker and help educate people about what it looks like, the different angles of dyslexia.
Right. Right. And again, it was just moms coming together, moms with connections, coming together with great people, experts who are educating and speaking to the parents. And the parents were like, yeah, that's my kid. That's my kid. What do I do? Here are answers. And I wish that could have come from the school district. I mean, in a perfect world, it will. And I think it will.
Do you think that we're going to get there?
I'm hopeful. I think that there's a lot of really good human beings in our district. I think money is a huge issue, and I wish we could decrease the fear. If I think that they could trust that the intention is not to sue, the intention is to kind of spread more support for more kids, which would be the best thing for our entire community, then...
I never understand why... learning to read, what they teach in schools has to be maybe it's the Common Core thing, but it's set for, you know, just like what they call the normal kids, when teaching dyslexic kids to read, that would also work for everyone else.
It's not going to harm the kids that don't
It's not going to harm them. It's not going to hold them back.
Yeah. But then, you know, it's not Common Core. So we do I think we were talking about this, about a school back east, Rhode Island or something. They just opened a charter school specifically for kids with dyslexia and dysgraphia and learning disabilities. And so I think that might be the way that it happens. The other way I could see it happening is if our public schools do have a special ed teacher or reading specialist that brings in a program that is multi-sensory, sequential, individualized, but that they're not doing it, that they're well-trained in it and there's ongoing training and it's not an aide that's doing it, because that's what happens a lot of time, and that there's not four kids in a group, that it's 2 to 3 kids in a group, and that the program is very just sound and overseen, then I could see things changing. But that's going to take money.
Do you know of any upcoming legislation or policy changes in California?
Well, we had the update in California for being able to even say dyslexia that we have now. So that's huge. And that was from parents. I believe it was in the Brentwood area that parents got together and and they made it happen. So we've made tremendous changes in the state in the last 2 years. So I'm hopeful. I've seen our staffs are getting trained in Orton-Gillingham. That's all new. That's happened in the last couple of years. It's happening, but it's not quick enough for parents like us who our kids are.
If you're already in the system, it's kind of too late.
Well, I think we could talk all day, but I know time is short. We all have places to be. So I just want to thank you so much for coming and spending a half an hour with us. I learned a lot.
There are things we can do. I just want to just instill hope in parents.
So I love about you, your positivity.
Oh, thank you.
That's awesome.
But thank you for this time.
Thank you so much.